The views and opinions expressed on this podcast belong solely to the individuals appearing on the program and do not necessarily reflect the views of the organizations with which they are associated.
I think as a sector, we have diagnosed some of the major problems.
I think on the optimistic side.
Like shifting the dialogue on local responses.
There has been
the emergence of a new generation of organizations.
It's about all together being capable to work for a collective objective.
Hi, you're listening to the Humanitarian Assistance Podcast, produced by ATA, the Advanced Training Program on Humanitarian Action. This podcast is a space for dialogue on current dilemmas facing the humanitarian sector. You can contribute to the discussion by visiting our site, ATA.se, where you'll find background information on each episode, our weekly blog, and more. Now let's get started.
Hello. And welcome to the ATA Humanitarian Assistance Podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Meredith Blake.
And I'm Julia Brooks. Today on the podcast, we're continuing our series on the protection of humanitarian action. In this episode, we're focusing on the duty of care of humanitarian organizations toward their own staff in insecure settings. We're also taking an in-depth look at security management, as well as increasing concerns over sexual assaults and violence within the humanitarian sector.
Due to the often austere, volatile, or insecure nature of humanitarian response settings, aid workers have long recognized the inherent personal and organizational risks of humanitarian action. Yet, increasing threats and attacks against aid workers have spurred renewed debate over organizational responsibilities to protect not only beneficiary populations, but also their own staff. Much of this debate has focused on the principle of duty of care and the ethical, professional, and legal obligations of organizations toward their staff, volunteers, and partners in the field. This episode is part of our series on the protection of humanitarian action, which builds on ATA's engagement with humanitarian practitioners over the challenges of operating in insecure environments and responding to violent attacks.
Joining us from the World Food Program are Erwan Rumen, Field Security Officer in Iraq, and Luigi Bocci, Field Security Officer in Afghanistan, who will discuss how security management and the protection of humanitarian actors plays out on the ground in insecure settings.
Now let's get started.
So thank you again both for joining us. This conversation follows in a series that we've been having here at ATA about the protection of humanitarian action and increasing concerns over violence against aid workers. So I wanted to ask you, as security officers with the World Food Program, Erwan in Iraq and Luigi working in Afghanistan, what do you see as the primary risks facing aid workers in insecure areas like the ones that you're working in? And what are some of the key elements of security management, successful security management in this context?
Well, regarding my context, the current one at least, then maybe we can speak more in general. I can see pretty much the risks related to aid workers mostly divided in two categories. One is for international and one is for national staff. As you can imagine, national staff are living here. They are facing the day-by-day life and their families are living here. So in some cases, they are much more exposed to, than us to general risks outside the wire, as we say, even because internationals are much more limited to work outside the compounds or these so-called by UN MOS compliant locations. The main risk that we are facing now are basically the abductions and things like this, but mostly if we want to relate this issue to the operations, you know, when a national staff is approached by government officials or non-state actors or non-government actors outside the working environment, but still while performing their duties, it's difficult from their side just to argue with them if they are put in a situation where they should say, yes, we can do this, or no, we cannot do this. Because at the end of the day, they will be facing any kind of consequence that could come from their reply or their answer, because they're much more blackmailed than us, I would say, because of their family, because of their exposure to a normal life. International staff, on the contrary, they are a little bit more, how can we say, a little bit more protected, and they can maintain also, and this is a positive thing, a more impartial and neutral approach to the operation, because they know that they will stay on the ground. First of all, they don't have this kind of close links, or they're not involved too much in these tribal issues, in this family related issues that are very important in this kind of context. So they can really approach the operation in a more, as I said, in a more neutral way. So a little bit less exposed to risks. Even if we're talking about a security profile, of course, as soon as we are out of our secure compounds, we become a high valuable target, much more than a national staff. This is pretty much in general. So I don't want to go too much into the specific threats that each of us is facing, but in general, this is what I think about the risks.
And Erwan, would you like to respond to that as well?
Yes, it's Erwan. I'm not going to be responding to Luigi because I agree with what he's saying. I think I'd like to make it larger or to narrow the, but to bring it to another approach and starting with the key elements of a successful security management. To my opinion, and I'm speaking in my personal capacity, to my opinion, the key elements to the security management, to the successful security management, is really to try to work, how do you say that in English, you know, on a cold blood, without passion, without hate, but to be really fair all the time, and basically to try to work from a fact-based analysis. And by doing so, security analysis, of course, trying really to differentiate two types of risk, and mostly the perceived risk, i.e., you know, when you are afraid of the dark, and in many cases, it's what we are, and we are focusing far too much on it, even if it's valid, because the fact that our colleagues, partners, ourselves are afraid is a risk, and we need to address this one. But we need to differentiate it from the actual risk. And we also need to, when we are doing that, we need to stay away from the sexy part of the business, you know. And when I'm speaking about the sexy part of the business, I'm speaking about, you know, descriptions and analysis of armed actors, of various tenants to a conflict, of their tactics, of their possible evolutions. All of that is extremely relevant and very useful. But coming to the first part of the question, you know, what are the primary risks facing head workers in insecure areas? If we move away from the sexy part of the analysis, we will very, and we, if we come to a fact-based security management approach, we are going to very easily identify that what is going to kill this year most head workers is going to be road safety and security. Because most head workers this year that are going to be dying are going to be dying on board vehicles, primarily simply from car accidents, and secondarily from security incidents with eventually, you know, IEDs or weapons involved, but from on the road and on board vehicles. So no matter what we are doing at the end of the day in terms of security management, we really come back to some basics. And very often, these basics are forgotten in the turmoil and the intensity of the daily situations we are handling and creating the operational requirements for our head.
And with regard to assessing risks, and Luigi, you touched on this a little bit, we've also been discussing how risks can vary greatly depending on the individual staff. For instance, we can talk in terms of nationality, gender, race, et cetera, et cetera. How do you take these differences into account to protect the team you have, whatever their individual profiles? And conversely, maybe, to what extent might these characteristics shape who's on the team in the first place, and how aid organizations decide who gets sent where?
Well, I want to get connected in answering to your question now, this question, to what Erwan said before. basically, sometimes it's also the perception of the risks that make the difference. And not only that one, but also the risk appetite that your management or yourself have in terms of exposing stuff of your, or yourself to this kind of identified threats or risks. I'm going to elaborate a little bit more. So the perception of risk, as Erwan said, if we look at the majority of the accident and the risk that our colleagues are facing, especially our colleagues traveling a lot, like food monitoring, to do food monitoring or to just to move or also to commute from their residences to the office, and I'm talking about national staff, is basically car accident. So it means that our staff are consistently exposed to this kind of risk, which is very common, and we, and I'm talking about also the management, keep accepting this kind of risk. While if we look at specific threat and incidents involving humanitarian workers while performing their duties are much, much lower, I'm talking about percentage, much, much lower than this kind of very simple risk to which each staff, you know, is exposed every day. In terms of acceptance or risk, the car accident can be justified if it happens by whoever, even by us, security officer, who have identified the risk and the threats, saying that, yeah, without this risk, we cannot operate. So it means without our staff commuting every day from home to the office, we cannot work. While we are a little bit more reluctant to accept risks when we are considering the fact that our staff are moving to risk areas to carry out their duties. So what I think we should focus on in terms of risk management is to understand or to analyze which kind of risks we are ready to accept against what we want to achieve versus what we want to achieve. And that's basically the way I see it. So the risk management, I think, is pretty much related to not only to the criticality of the operation itself, but also it's a very personal approach. And as we know, most of the time, security is not a science. Security is based on perceptions, which is very difficult to identify indicators saying that we do this because of these indicators, or we don't do this because of these indicators. It's how you perceive these indicators, which is something important also when we have a more general approach, which is something that personally, not organization-wise, but personally, I'm pretty much keen with, which is try to understand what we want to achieve. Do we want to maintain this, especially for international, this distance from the operations, just going there or going to location where we think it's safe to go, or we want to have a more general and in-depth monitoring of what we are doing, also accepting risk, moving to risk areas. If we do the latter, I think we have to be ready to accept risks, which is something that I am personally available to do. But sometimes, if we look at other colleagues, they may not feel so comfortable to do it. So to me, it's a very personal, in terms of risk management, it's a very personal issue in terms of approach and consideration and acceptance. What I see is also something that we very seldom put into the equation when we do an assessment of the risks. So the acceptance of our presence of humanitarian operations in some area, especially risk areas, is part of these mitigation measures or not? And if it is, can we come out with a level that tells me, yes, we can accept these risks because we we are accepted by the local community or by the non-state actors operating in that area, because I see so, because I have discussed with them, because I have negotiated with them, and I have got the perception that we are safe, or we want just to base our acceptance on, or we don't want to use the acceptance of our presence there and consider only those historical data. And I'm talking about incidents that have been happening in that specific areas. So this is, in general, this is my approach and the way I see the risk and the that we are facing on the ground and the risk management, how it develops and is put into the humanitarian activities.
And Erwan, did you want to follow up on that?
I think to summarize a little bit what Luigi was saying, I think there are two things that are a bit two concepts basically. First concept is the and first risk is the way we are accepting risks and what kind of risk in our daily life, you know. And recent events in Stockholm, Paris, London, everywhere in the world have proven that, you know, something that is considered as a routine in Kabul or Iraq is considered as a complete trauma in these locations. And it's quite clear when you take some perspective that the overreaction that has existed in these recently affected countries is also linked to the fact that even recent histories from the 80s and 90s has been forgotten, whereas currently immediate history lived in Kabul, Iraq, or other locations, Kabul, Baghdad, or other locations, makes it that, you know, there is some kind of complacency towards this the exposure to these high-risk environments. So the point is that the first risk there would be because aid workers are living, and you see the way I'm speaking about these recent attacks in these locations, you know. So because aid workers are living in high-risk environments, they get used to be living in high-risk, and they become complacent, or they are becoming less cautious regarding their daily approach, which in itself is a risk. And overall, the issue that security has around that, what Luigi was saying, is definitely the definition for security professional and the understanding of the risk appetite level, both of the organization, of the staff, generally speaking, and on this exact day where the mission is going to be conducted. So it's really not some science. It's really some smelling every day what's the atmosphere to know where we are going to put the bar in terms of how much risk we are going to be taking or not. And also, is it worth it or not to reach our beneficiaries? Coming back to the how does our organization account for individual staff differences? Well, I think both Luigi and I, we mentioned it, we are working for the UN. So as a matter of fact, the UN, and it's where, you know, politics interfere in some cases in security management. So as a matter of fact, the UN do not differentiate. Does that have an impact on our security assessment? Yes, it does. Because in many cases, we could find as security professionals some solutions to identify some staff members with some profiles that could, you know, based on a maybe not completely fact-based analysis, that could, and personal analysis, that could be maybe less exposed to some type of security risk than some others. Having said that, we are the UN, so we are not going into that direction, and it's definitely, I think, a clear policy. I remember when I was in Darfur, WFP has been confronted to three nearly consecutive in less than 18 months kidnapping incident. Okay, each time the profile of these staff members were Westerners because locally they were considered as having higher value. This had led some organizations such as, I won't name them, but some other organizations, not the UN, some very strong organizations in terms of security management, to decide not to accept Westerners to operate in Darfur. This was definitely not possible approach for the UN and for WFP. So we had to find some other solutions, and one of the solutions was to accept this higher risk exposure for this type of profile. So of course, there are some caveats to what I'm saying, and I'm saying that we are not differentiating. We are trying to get better at identifying specific security measures and analysis in regards, especially of a gender. But again, there we really have some weak statistics basis to tell us what are the actual issues linked to gender, and the overall analysis, you know, of mitigating measures to implement, whether it's better to have a woman or a man, depending on the context, is always biased. And at the end of the day, as a security professional, I have never been sure that even in the locations the less conducive for, obviously conducive for women to operate, I've never been sure that not sending them was actually better for the organization, and I've never been sure that a woman would not have done better in this context. So all of that is still, I think, in this term of how we address this type of difference, of staff differences, is still at the early stages, because we really do lack some kind of fact-based analysis that could tell us, yes, this works, this is not to be done or not. There is no rule there. And finally, to bring a last caveat to what I was saying on the fact that we do not differentiate, there is only one differentiation that is formally made in the UN Security Management System. It's between national and international, and only for when we consider the evacuation from a country because we cannot operate anymore. And even there, in some cases, the national and internationals are going to be considered the same. So yes, we don't differentiate.
Thank you very much for that. I wanted to ask, following up on Erwan, on your comments, you spoke about decisions about risk exposure and where to operate or decide not to operate. I wanted to return to the question of security management serving as an enabler rather than a restrictor of programming. This has been mentioned by many of our prior panelists as a really critical factor in getting across the importance of security, especially to other practitioners and programs in the field. Could you say a bit more about that?
Yeah, and I've got a very strong opinion on this one. And I understand the concerns of non-security professionals in regards to this, the fact that security can be considered in some cases as a restrictor to the programs. So, of course, I'm going to make something a bit controversial to explain my point, but I am in many ways believing that the reasons why there are increasing concerns over violence against aid workers, the reasons why aid workers are more and more dying when exposed to a high level of risk in conflict environments, is the pendant of the success of a deployment of their security teams. What I mean there is that because there are more and more requirements for aid workers to be present everywhere to address all issues, because over the last two decades, more and more humanitarian assistance has been triggered by conflict-related environments rather than drought, flooding, etc. This has pushed the aid workers to equip themselves more and more with some security teams that have arrived there and that have helped these aid workers to take more and more risks. It's where I'm not completely comfortable with this with question. You know, how can security management serve as an enabler rather than restrictor of programs? I'm pretty sure that we are actually really serving as enablers. And that most operations in which we are currently operating, Afghanistan is definitely one, Darfur is another, South Sudan is definitely one, Iraq is one. If you don't have security management, you don't have an operation.
Well,
Sorry. I want to add something.
Yeah.
Just one point. And that, of course, it's Erwan speaking again. As part of this security management, there are various levels of success of this security management, as there are various levels of successful logistic program operations. It all depends on the level of success of this security management or security operation.
My point of view on this one is pretty much in line with what Erwan said. And most probably in Afghanistan, what we are facing now is, in terms of risk management, is pretty much related to politics. And I can say why, I can explain why. For example, before I mentioned something regarding acceptance of our presence in some areas, and of course, to create a certain kind of acceptance, you need to explain to whoever is in control of these risk areas what you are doing, the way you are doing it, why you are not going to do some projects in some areas that maybe they are pretty much eager to have, or they are pushing you, or they are asking you to have. Having said that, to create this kind of environment and understanding, you need to get in touch with these people. If you cannot go there, because, for example, there is a very famous and well-known sanction list, also for UN, but not only for UN. And it's a sanction list that some countries who are donors or are supporting operations, and not only for UN, have created. And this list doesn't allow you to get in touch with certain actors or certain prominent figures in some areas. This is a limitation. It's a limitation for us because the only alternative we have is to reach these people through interlocutors. And so this means that we have to put all our faith on them in order to ensure that our message is reaching them in the right way. And of course, at the moment the message is sent, you have, and I go back to what I said at the beginning, you have a national person most of the time dealing with them. So he is not in a position also to, not to argue, but to contest what these people are answering or are telling them. So this kind of political aspect, which is an argument and a topic that I've been able to discuss in different missions I've been serving so far, is a big limitation that has been brought to the attention of the donors. So if you don't allow me to do to create the environment, the proper operational environment through negotiations with the right people, so with the influential actors or actors in control of the areas where I'm operating, you don't give me a blank check to implement my risk management approach, because you take away from me that aspect that I said before is the one of the most important ones, to understand the acceptance that I have or I could have with my presence and operation in that area. Here's one point. On the other side, we have, and this is something that I witnessed, I'm not working for ICRC, but I've been able to work in areas where also ICRC was operating. And we know that between ICRC and UN, there is a completely different kind of approach, and also a different kind of risk management. But what I've seen, and this is something that Erwan mentioned briefly, operating in areas with a certain kind of security environment, like during the last, maybe I would say starting from, I would say around 99, 2000, where politics plays a big role in the implementation of the activities, while on the other side, we know before humanitarians were mainly involved in natural disaster responses. You have an approach that is pretty much based on politics, and not only politics, also politics, I'm talking about the normal politics, the conventional politics. Then you have the unconventional one, where you have also the terrorist aspect involved. So negotiating with some groups is not as easy or straightforward of negotiating with the official institutions. Because of this, we have seen also ICRC, who was pretty much ready to serve everybody blindfolded, using armored vehicles in some areas where before they were just moving around with soft skin vehicles. This means that also the perception of this open-minded organization and pretty much open to have an approach, a direct approach with different actors in the areas, has been reviewed. And this is not a limitation. To me, this is an adaptation of the situation in order to carry out your operation. If not, you cannot, because at the moment you get involved in an incident, you cannot continue to operate in the same way, or you cannot continue sometimes to operate in that area for some time. So you have to stop the operations, because you have to review your approach, because something has changed that you were not aware of. So something that you didn't see coming. And so that's the reason why I'm saying that the risk management is related to, has changed big time and pretty much limited by politics. I've had recently a discussion about this just with the different colleagues, but not only security colleagues, also program related to programs. And I told them, if we look at the preparedness stage of the operations, we can see that security is less and less involved in this. This is a personal point of view. This is a personal assessment that could be contested, and I'm ready to discuss about this. But if you take out the security component from the initial planning of any operation, you, as a program officer, you don't see some aspects that could hamper that operation, specific operation, because you don't see it coming, while a security professional can foresee things like that coming. So also the risk management is the approach to the risk management should be should include the security component a little bit more at the initial stage, which is something that is not, according to my personal opinion, it's not happening. Then going very quickly about gender, and I want just very quickly to mention something about gender. We have this kind, I can see this approach of using women or not women or for some activities. In an environment like, and I make it very simple, in Afghanistan, we can see a little bit of reluctancy coming from the staff, also national staff, to have female staff to be involved in operations, especially where there are movement and travel and trips involved. We are trying, as an international organization, as a humanitarian organization that wants to include the gender aspect into our operations, we want to and allow me to use this term, force the gender component inside our operations in an environment where the gender is seen in a very specific way. So we are trying to break a cultural approach that, if it's coming from outside, I think, personal opinion, that will be never accepted by the community. On the contrary, if this approach in terms of gender comes from the inside, so we can be the promoter, we can be the institutions that start this kind of, create this kind of sensitization on gender, but we are not the enablers. We are using the local community, the people who understand and who can accept this kind of approach, different approach, to send out the message to the community In that case, we might have a little bit more understanding, and we could create a little bit more gender acceptance in our operation. So we cannot be the outsider coming in, telling them what to do. But we should be the outsider trying to bring in new ideas and new way to look at operational approach also. And let the national staff or the national organizations taking care of it. In that way, they may find also the best way to sensitize other people and to create the environment to expand a little bit more or to have more gender component in the operations. That's it.
When Erwan speaking, one quick word on gender. Agree with everything what Luigi was saying about gender and security, but basically, I think the quick point on gender that we are still at the early stages of security management and gender issues, and that currently, from a purely fact-based approach, there is no evidence that having some women in the deep field in any situation is really more risky than not having them.
Thank you for that. I think that's a really important point and really interesting reflections on both gender and many of the political aspects of this. I wanted to ask you both about duty of care, which has been a focus of this podcast as well. We've seen the concept of duty of care rising in prominence in the humanitarian sector, referring to the organizational responsibilities of employers toward their staff in the field, whether the legal responsibility or as a moral, ethical, or professional responsibility. So as security managers in insecure settings, I wanted to ask you, what does duty of care mean to you beyond merely a catchphrase? How do you see this playing out on the ground? And also, how do you see the debates or the evolution of this concept at the higher management level as well?
Luigi, you want me to go for it?
Yeah, you have a lot to say. Yes, please. Yeah.
So it will be Erwan speaking. Okay, first, I think it's good that you you mentioned the possible difference between duty of care and what it means for us on the ground and what it could be at the higher management. Very quickly, on the ground. The duty of care on the ground, well, first, the concept of duty of care, let me start with that. It's far from being security only. And I've heard these concerns in regards to insufficient support in the aftermath of attack against some practitioners, etc., etc. But the fact is that, especially in 2017, the level of security support provided to staff is, in most cases, extremely significant. In some cases, it could even be considered as too significant, and we are maybe going too far in some cases in terms of cost efficiency or a couple of things. So, what does it mean the duty of care in the ground? Well, I have to say not much. And why? Because the duty of care for who? You know, it's where we have to draw a line there in the field. Because where does the duty of care for our beneficiary stops? And where does the duty of care for our staff member starts? So basically, if we don't want our colleagues and staff members, you know, to take any risk, and if really we are pushing the duty of care for them to the maximum, then we are completely possibly denying the access of our personnel to beneficiaries. So there is a balance to find here. And definitively, this balance is called risk acceptance. And it's what we always need to take into consideration. It's also what triggers the resources dedicated to security. To my opinion, as a security professional, it's completely acceptable and normal that we try to maintain the level of resources for security at the minimum they can be, so that we can allocate most our resources to deliver our mandate. And again, the risk acceptance there is important, especially bearing in mind that nowadays security expenditures can be completely massive and can kill an operation if we don't pay attention. So this was at the field level, you know. Where do we draw the line between the duty of care for our personnel and the duty of care for personnel for beneficiaries, and who is encompassed in the concept of duty of care. At the higher level, I would tend to say that the duty of care concept, and I'm going to be a bit cynical there, and maybe again controversial, but the duty of care at the higher level is more of an administrative, bureaucratic, financial process, at least in terms of security, than anything else. Currently, the debates are to know who is going to be covered by the insurance systems that are taking into account the possible incidents affecting our personnel. And I think it's more or less legitimate. There are other debates ongoing at the higher level of the UN. They are still starting, but of course they are incorporating staff well-being, because it's also a concern. Because yes, in some cases, the security in the field is so well taken care of that staff have absolutely no life and spent 3, 4, 5 years in jail inside a bunker with no movement whatsoever and limited access to food, proper anything. It encompasses psychological support, it encompasses information sharing, communication, pre-deployment trainings, pre-deployment screenings, etc. And all of that has some massive implications. And to be honest, I'm not so sure that all these discussions are going to make it better in the field, because at the end of the day, we need to be clear on why we are here for. And we are in the field, we are in these countries to take some risk to our life, because we as individuals are working in an organization that believes, like us, that taking this level of risk outweighs the benefits that we can provide by delivering our assistance to our beneficiaries. So it's why...
I can only see this duty of care a big argument to focus on, because as Erwan said, if we look at our duty of care for our staff and for ourselves as part of certain organizations, humanitarian organizations, we end up to finish to a very strict approach in terms of security. At that point, you can mention that the risk management for that approach is a limitation, because it doesn't allow us to go to those areas or those locations to do what we are supposed to do, or to carry out firsthand the task we are supposed to do as an organization. That's the reason why all of a sudden, years ago, there was this famous approach called transfer of risks, and where the management of certain organizations decided to implement in order to minimize the risk of their own staff, and asking at the same time other people, other staff, other humanitarian workers to be exposed to those kind of risks. Of course, we need to consider the security profile of different level of humanitarian workers, which is something not nice to say, but that's the reality on the ground. So we have really, as Erwan mentioned, two different kind of levels of duty of care that we need to focus on. One on the ground, which is how do you want to implement your operations if the management at higher level doesn't allow you to operate in a certain way, in a more free way. Of course, if we look at this kind of two different levels, they are in such a position that they will never meet each other. So it means that we will keep distanciating some staff or some organizations from the real operation on the ground, while using other organizations who are more prone to accept certain risks for different reasons. One of those reasons is the security profile of the of their staff on the ground to accept these risks. So enabling operation is a very, there's a very tiny line between want to go up to where you want to go to accept the risk or not. So we go back to the risk appetite, we go back to responsibilities, not last the financial aspect related to liability, insurances, and all these kind of things that are also related to the level of protection that some organization want to provide to their own staff to minimize the risks. So cost, huge costs in terms of assets, physical security, including armored vehicles and big perimeter walls, and all these kind of things.
I'd like to add one point, Luigi.
Yeah,
and that is for Julia and the team. No, it might look like we are a bit tough, you know, on what we are saying. And basically what we are saying, we can make it a bit shorter by saying we are concerning duty of care. And what we are communicating is, okay, if you are not willing to take risks, don't come here, because you are not going to be operating. But the first point on that is just to let you know that, of course, people like Luigi and myself, and certainly Luigi, even more than me, are the first ones to go, at least for of international staff, to go there and to make the assessment to enable our colleagues then to take this risk. So we know what we are speaking about and we know what kind of risk we are knowing. And this knowledge is key. And we come back to the perceived risk, actual risk, risk habituation. But it's where, you know, the information sharing about the true risk that you are taking, and so that you sign off, you know on what you are signing off, it's where there is this link between what we are living in the ground and the discussions in headquarters around the duty of care. Because yes, one key element there is to ensure that the staff members, the personnel, we have the head workers that the headquarters are sending deep in the field to make it happen, know why and what type of risk they are taking for themselves, and are in many ways confident that they are happy to do it like that.
Thank you. And we've talked about a variety of risks facing aid workers in the field. Today we've talked about kidnapping, shootings, car accidents that you've both worked to prevent and mitigate. But in an earlier section of this podcast, we heard specifically from several panelists about the prevalence of sexual violence within the humanitarian sector, that is sexual assault against aid workers, not only by external or armed actors, but often by their own colleagues. And I think, Erwan, you mentioned earlier a lack of adequate statistics or fact-based analysis with regard to gender. And our panelists noted that recent surveys show sexual assaults to be much more widespread in the aid sector than previously thought, due to a lot of underreporting. And we've heard that there's often an onus on women to explain or justify to their male coworkers why they feel unsafe. For example, if they're staying out after curfew, which indicates that issues specific to women may not be adequately addressed in trainings or protocols. And there's another facet of that, that security managers tend to be overwhelmingly male, so maybe less aware or less comfortable discussing these issues. And on the same token, women may be less comfortable coming to them to discuss issues of sexual violence. And they've also noted that a very few agencies even have robust policies or procedures for prevention and with regard to security training, investigation, or response to sexual assault. Are there specific measures that you've put in place or that you would foresee or recommend putting into place, whether in terms of initial risk assessment, training, prevention, or responding after these assaults, in order to begin addressing this issue?
Okay, first, about the statistics themselves. And it's a bit complicated, the statistics around sexual assaults. And at this stage, I'm not sure they are yet relevant, because it's a bit like worldwide, you know, sexual assault worldwide has statistically an issue. Because if you look at the statistics worldwide, then you discover that the number one countries in the world that has an issue with sexual assault is Sweden. which is probably not the case, and there are probably some statistical biases there. So I'm not sure that we should be looking into these issues from a statistics perspective, and definitely it's not what has triggered all the efforts, not saying successful, that have been made there. So you were speaking about the training, overwhelming presence of male as security professionals, difficulties of females to report and to mention to other males. All that, those points are actually well taken. From a personal perspective, when I joined the UN, when I became some kind of at least humanitarian worker, it was the first time in my career that I was working with in a mixed environment. Actually, I was in a portion of the army before where there were only males. So, of course, for me, it was pretty new, and it took me some time to adapt to it. I'd like to say that my first reaction was, on the contrary, to be overprotective in regards to my female colleagues, and basically to believe that they had to be completely protected at every time, but no, of course, they couldn't do that, that I had to do it. So there is, you know, different aspects to it. Yes, I believe that, as you mentioned, under-reporting is definitely probably a big issue. It's generally the case for security incidents. Security incidents worldwide are rather under-reported. These ones, sexual assault, are even more under-reported, probably. The difficulties for women to go and speak to male, that in my case, I've not witnessed that too much. And it's where I would say that security professionals, with the status they have, the stature, and maybe in some cases, this type of positions they have in the organization, that they are close, very close from management, but not part of the management, are definitively a known good entry point in some cases, not all, for these victims of this type of assaults, because in most cases there is an understanding that confidentiality and adequate level of reaction can be an option. There has been a lot of work in all the security units, teams, divisions worldwide to try to have more women on board to address some of these issues. It's a more general problem. It's more difficult, the recruitment of women in the security teams. And they are welcome, but it's, I think, similar to other branches of a business, of industries where you have more women and it's difficult for men to go there. It's traditionally and culturally not working as well or as easily as it should. And so finally, the only thing that is really a bit working and that we have developed there is specific trainings. And we have a very successful security women awareness training in WFP. It's not going to be a surprise that first it has been created and developed by some women, but it's not a surprise also that it's very recent. It's, I think, less than 1 year old, and still the problem is not there. So basically, I can only say yes to all the comments and part of the questions you have, and I will have nothing to say that we are doing well in that aspect.
Well, from my side, I have just two things to say, very practical things. Yes, I can agree that the sexual assaults have become an issue among the international humanitarian community. However, I don't know how much is reliable this kind of statistic. Because we may also consider the fact that before, most of these cases were not reported. So now, all of a sudden, also because of this gender component in the operations, we started looking a little bit more into this sexual cases or sexual assault cases. Having said that, and because of this, some trainings have been identified, prepared, and are currently conducted all over the world among most of the humanitarian organizations. This is what I understand. Mostly what these trainings are for is just to develop a certain kind of awareness. So awareness, knowing that we are going to operate in countries where the perception of the presence of the, for example, of a woman among men, talking about issues that in that specific society is usually dealt with only by men, has to be considered very carefully. So these awareness trainings that are conducted worldwide, plus, because of this training, mitigation measures that are identified, like, for example, I can give you some mitigation measures that we have in place right now here, but were in place also in other missions before this one. For example, we have a shuttle service for our female staff from the office to wherever they feel comfortable to be dropped off. Leaving the office at a certain time, especially mostly during daylight, not moving around or leaving the office during dark hours. And then, of course, I would say use of armored vehicles also to some places where our male colleagues are going with or could go with soft skin vehicles. So all these kind of things are in place. So I really don't know what more we could do on this. Of course, the mentality and the approach of the management in terms of risk appetite is still there. So even if we are looking at this gender approach, the concerns of the management regarding an incident involving a woman is still, if you ask me, and this is what I feel, this is what I see, this is what I hear, is felt a little bit worse than of an incident involving men stuff. So this is, even if we are aware and we are trying to avoid certain things happening in general, in terms of risk management, but still we are most probably the first one to create this kind of difference between women and males. So I think that what we can, there is always room for improvement, but I think that what we can do, I'm talking practical things, is on the right path. So we are moving there. Still, as I said, I don't know the statistics. I cannot confirm this because I don't have a scientific knowledge of this. I didn't do researches, but the reports of sexual violence or incidents related to sexual violence right now are more investigated, more reported than before. So most probably this has become an issue that which is important. Don't get me wrong, that we should we had to focus on.
To come back on this point and the statistics, you know, that we cannot really handle properly. I would tend to say that it's actually quite positive to see that the statistics on this type of sexual abuse and violence are increasing, because I'm really convinced that it's not the numbers that are actually increasing of actual incidents. It's better reporting. So these incidents, to my opinion, are just better reported. From what I see in the way they are managed, they are taken very, very seriously by everybody in the organizations. So what I see, I've got the impression that our colleagues, whether male or female, or you know, are feel more comfortable in reporting these. Hopefully, with time, we'll have 100% of reports on that, and from there, we'll see a constant and quick decline.
Thank you, and I'd like to give each of you the opportunity to offer your closing thoughts or reflections. We've touched on a variety of important topics today, ranging from security management and risk appetite in the field, key elements of successful security strategies for enabling programs, some of the differences between individual staff members, as well as how duty of care is playing out in the field, and as you just spoke about, in particular, challenges around gender and sexual violence. So I wanted to ask you sort of your closing reflections on what are the most important things to keep in mind with regard to improving the protection of aid workers in the field. What's most important looking forward? What do you see as key developments? Or what are your final thoughts on the conversation we've been having today?
No, it's Erwan speaking. It was really about this question that I thought that was made me think a little bit. But it was, how do you create a culture of effective security management within an organization? Well, my first answer would be, wow, if you know the answer, you tell me so that I can do it. My second thought was, you don't create a culture of effective security management because you cannot delink security management from management short. So if you have an organization, I have not witnessed any organization that has an effective management and not an effective security management. It goes together.
Okay, now from my side, I'm going to be very, 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 very brief. Just 2 points. So we need to decide in terms of protection of staff where we want to stand in terms of humanitarian presence on the ground. Do we want boots on the ground or we want risk on transfer of risks? If you ask me, this is a very, very objective approach that each management, it depends where you are, is going to have. And I think, unfortunately, that there is very little that a security component could change this kind of approach, unless there is a lot of money available that you can ensure movement and presence everywhere because you have the money to create the protection of your staff in those specific locations. So to me, the risk management is pretty much based on personal perception and personal approach to operations. So, of course, risk appetite. And of course, the limits that you as a management create by yourself for your organization. Because talking about specifically for UN, when we identify security mitigation measures, it's not one organization identifying these security mitigation measures or these security requirements. It's a group of people, security professional, identifying some options, proposing these options to the management, and then the security professionals at that point, they are out of the equation. So it's the management that decides which kind of approach or which kind of security mitigations will be put in place. So this is, to me, if you ask me, it's very difficult to go somewhere if the issue remains very objective.
Thank you very much both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Once again, that was Erwan Rumen and Luigi Boshi, security officers with the World Food Program in Iraq and Afghanistan, respectively.
That's all the time we have for this episode of the Humanitarian Assistance Podcast. We'd like to thank again all of our panelists for joining us today. We'd also like to thank our sound engineer, David Goodman, and the rest of our colleagues here at ATA.
And remember, you can find resources related to the podcast by visiting us online at ata.se. That's ATHA.SE. There you'll find extended editions of all of our conversations today. And if you have feedback, you can reach us on Twitter at ATA Sweden.
Finally, be sure to tune in next month for our next episode of the Humanitarian Assistance Podcast. Until then, I'm Julia Brooks.
And I'm Meredith Blake. On behalf of the Advanced Training Program on Humanitarian Action, thanks for listening.